Welcome to New Lens with Common Good Capital, where we talk with investors, RIAs, fund managers, and philanthropists about their experiences within the impact investing space, as well as explore the power of stewardship and capital. As most of you know, my name is Jeff Schaefer. I am the host and I'm the CEO of Common Good Capital. I'm very excited about this conversation today. Robin and I met maybe a month ago, and so Robin O'Brien is with us. If you Google her name, you'll actually find a lot about you out there. Robin is a best-selling author, speaker, entrepreneur, and investor who thrives at the intersection of courage, authenticity, innovation, and leadership. You've written, that I know of, a couple books. Have you written more than that?
Just two so far.
Any more on the way?
I think I have a third one in me.
Okay. All right. But her critically acclaimed books, The Unhealthy Truth, How Our Food is Making Us Sick, and What We Can Do About It, she wrote in 2009. I'm sure we'll hear about that. But additionally, your latest is Seeding Innovation, The Path to Profit and Purpose in the 21st Century. And these obviously establish you as a thought leader and a change maker. And then I will shut up here. I don't know if I've ever said this on the podcast, but I really want to get guests on here who not just talk about making change, but are risking and doing it. And when I first met you, that was like, okay, we got to get you on. So, I should say last thing, you are a partner at Montcalm. And actually I've known Montcalm for the last 10 years, which is a registered investment advisor. So high level, thank you so much for coming on.
Thanks for having me.
Start off, where are you located right now physically?
I am physically located in Boulder, Colorado, where I've been for almost 25 years, raised my four children, and the wind is whipping outside right now.
So Boulder to me is one of those beautiful places that when you drive up and see it from a distance, if you don't get some chills or in awe, you need to get poked because something's missing in your insides, or you got walls on it. Do you concur with that?
Yeah, it's really been pretty fascinating. I was born and raised in Houston, Texas, which is a lot different to Boulder, and a really, just a traditional conservative Southern family. And when we moved to Boulder 25 years ago, Boulder at that point in time still was sort of the epicenter for the growth of the organic industry. It still had a lot of really progressive hippie components to it. It's changed a lot in the last 25 years. But what has not changed are those mountains. And what I've found, I've always been a runner. I've been a lifelong runner. And when I am stuck on anything, if I am stuck on something personally or professionally, all I have to do is go to the mountains and do a hike. And what is so incredible about living here is it is literally, you can literally walk out your door to those trails or take a quick, 5-minute drive and you're at the trails. And the mountains become this incredible muse. I mean, they just hold all of this information and all this knowledge, for the years that so many people have passed through here. So I feel really lucky to have access to that because, as you know, especially in our industry or any industry, really, life can throw wild curveballs at you. And early in my career, I had a woman that I worked for in a fixed income desk, and she said, your happiness in life is determined by how you handle those curveballs. And there have been so many times where I've been thrown a curveball and I'm just like, I got to go hike, and I just head straight to the mountain to try to unpack it and solve it. And it's honestly the healthiest way I know how to do that.
I grew up, and maybe I've told you this, but I grew up in the state of Oregon. And actually, the data point for you was just fascinating. So when I was real young, I grew up in Eugene, which is running a beautiful, probably feels like you're going back 25 years from a hippie perspective, but then the running is massive there. So my uncle, I do not have any of his blood, although I've done marathons, was a world-class marathoner. He's now probably 70. So I grew up watching Alberto Salazar, Mary Decker Slaney at Eugene. And so two things, running, like you described, is that I don't do it as much because I had back surgery, and mountains. Living in Florida, both my wife and I love the mountains. And there's just something, especially when you're in Florida, to go into the mountains, the fresh air. I mean, it's amazing. So I'm coming out to visit you in Boulder one of these days, and we're going to go for a hike. Okay, so give us, because I didn't say it in the intro. Here's what I'd love. Quickly, where'd you grow up? And then a little bit of your career so that before we get into this, people get a sense of what you bring to this discussion and kind of from what experiences.
Yeah, I grew up in Houston, Texas, went to a conservative prep school down there for 12 years, and then went away to college in Virginia, applied to do a Fulbright, got that, went to Paris, France, lived in Paris, knew nobody. It was the first time I ever walked into something where I just knew nothing and had been told to go to the American Cathedral in Paris where they would post, apartments way before the internet. They post apartments and places where you could rent. And I was standing in front of this bulletin board, and these two women came up behind me and started speaking Dutch, and they thought I was Dutch. I turned, we went and had coffee. They were like, you're going to be our roommate. It was such an immediate an immediate bond. They were with a program called Erasmus, which is a legal program. You know, they're attorneys now. And they were there. They had this amazing apartment right in the middle of Paris. Came back, really had at that point, the doors to my imagination had been blown wide open. And came back, worked for an advertising agency because I had studied French, Spanish, and Japanese in college and thought, you know, I love communication, but this isn't going to translate. So how do I translate this? Got into this agency, was managing some of the bigger clients and had not had any accounting or finance and realized I had to go back to business school. So I applied to two business schools. I got a full scholarship to Rice University. So that was the decision, chose to go to Rice. And it was absolutely game changing. That education at that particular time with that particular faculty, there was magic in it because the courses that I took completely changed the lens with which I viewed the world. One class in particular was an ethics class, and it just absolutely reframed business. And it unlocked this understanding that I carried through and I still carry through today. It's why I'm an adjunct professor there, because I just want to give back to a program that gave me so much. But from there, you know, I was being recruited by the oil and gas industry because it's Houston. Exxon and Enron were big recruiters on campus. Enron took about a third of our class at the time, and they were really, really aggressive in their recruiting. I had zero interest in that company at the time. They were not used to hearing no. So that was a little bit tenuous at times. And I chose to go to work for an investment company that is now Invesco. And as the only woman on the team, the guys assigned me to cover the food industry. And we were covering tech and all these other things, but that was my focus area. And, you know, I really was not a food person, but, you know, had learned all the sort of number crunching and all the skills you get out of grad school.
When you say food, define that for us.
With all the publicly traded companies, like, you know, with things like Costco, things like Walmart, Safeway, you know, General Mills. And so I was covering that sector for the team. At the same time, we launched the company's first hedge fund, which was absolutely an incredible experience. So our team had about $20 billion in assets under management. And then at the same time, we would huddle on the weekends as we were literally creating and launching the company's first hedge fund and figuring out how to market it and how to communicate it internally and how do we educate our marketing department about what's a hedge fund and what we're doing. I mean, I look back on that experience and I am so grateful to have been in the right place at the right time with the right team. Just pure luck. And so I think, you know, as I look at my career, there's a lot of hard work, there's a lot of tenacity, there's a lot of honesty, and then there's luck. Luck plays a role sort of in the timing of these things. And I was extremely lucky to be there at that time. We were the top performing fund. And at the awards dinner for that year, when we were recognized as the top performing fund in the company, I was fully 9 months pregnant. And all of the guys had bet on the due date of that first baby because it's finance guys and everybody's competing with everybody. And we're sitting in this beautiful dinner, absolutely just beautiful world-class restaurant. And the waiter walks up with a silver platter of freshly cut jalapenos. And I'm like, what is this? You know, as if it wasn't obvious enough, because I was this 9-month pregnant woman and a man. And he walks up and he's like, you know, here's his plate. Do you order this? And I was like, I did not order this. And one of the guys who had bet that the due date would be the next day had intentionally ordered this full platter of spicy jalapenos. At that point, I was overdoing it. I was like, fine, you know, sprinkle these things on my dinner. And sure enough, my oldest child came the next day. We moved to Colorado shortly thereafter, and I had taken some time off to sort of have these kids. I knew I wanted a big family. I also loved my career, so I wanted to get through that quickly, and had 4 kids in 5 years, which is pretty crazy. But all now they're, you know, almost 20 to 25, and the closeness of them as a unit, as a squad, is incredible to watch. But, you know, landing in Boulder, Colorado from Houston, Texas was like night and day. At that point in time, the cultures could not have been more different. It was something that was totally new to me. I had one phone number, I knew one person, and thought, you know, I'll throw myself into this. And hiking actually was sort of the thing that held me when I first got here, as I was just processing the newness of everything. I stayed really close with all of the analysts and all of the guys that I had worked with. I mean, I have held them really closely for the last 30 years. And then when my youngest child was born, she had this life-threatening allergic reaction. And I thought, you know, like, what is actually going on? So it threw me back into the food industry, but from a different angle of sort of unpacking and discovering these incredible changes that had happened in the food system. And as I was working through that, you know, and began to advocate for that, because I had that finance background, CEOs of these multinational companies started reaching out. And they were like, look, you get it. You can say things we can't say. My son has autism, or my wife has this, you know, and I just suddenly, like, I could tell you, like, which CEOs of which companies are dealing with which things in their family. And they confided in me. And then they were like, help us think about this. How do I articulate this? What are the things I need to be thinking about? And so I began a lot of this high-level consulting in the food industry. And what quickly became very clear was we haven't financed healthy systems. And so we'd subsidize to a very large degree a very destructive food system. We were subsidizing basically the destruction of the food system, the soil, and ultimately, you know, human health and climate health. And again, the family that I grew up in is like, we didn't, you know, that this was all uncovering all of this. And it quickly was obvious that that's the lever. We've got to think about how we allocate capital. It's the first ingredient in any system, healthcare system, food system, education system. Capital is the first thing in. And whatever values are attached to that capital are going to dictate the quality of that system. And so then from that point on, really began to sort of bring back that capital focus and say, how do we actually finance the transition of these systems to better for you, whatever system we're talking about? And was co-founder of a company called Replant Capital that then introduced me to Montcalm. We were on their platform, which is then when I met Holly. And as the two of us put our heads together, it was really clear that we shared values. We shared a vision for literally how do we expand this and how do we create the source of energy in capital to drive this change and to create these smarter, more efficient, more resilient, more regenerative systems.
I'm chuckling because I've had those same conversations with Holly. And she, and I mean this in a wonderful way, she is a dreamer. And I don't mean just out in the sky, but she is a dreamer going after it to try to make a difference. And in fact, you kind of would say this if she was here, it sometimes you have to go, I agree with you, but you're like four steps ahead of how you'd want to articulate that, even though I agree with what you're saying. So she's a lovely person, and I've gotten to know her the last 10 years myself. So interesting background. Tell me this, why'd you go to Boulder? And then was it having kids that took you out of that profession? Or did you just, why'd you leave traditional, the hedge fund area?
We came to Boulder because when I was pregnant with our first, I knew if I stayed in Houston, I would be able to tell you everything I was going to do from my 20s to my 60s into my 70s. I mean, I know that path. And I wanted a different story. I wanted my children to have a different story. I didn't want them to be in the same school I had been in, you know, just for them to have their own story. And then just, you know, the opportunity presented itself. You know, something that I have used to navigate my entire life, which I think is relevant here, is that our lives unfold in chapters. And so, you know, I've always felt like nothing was permanent. And I remember thinking at the time, like, if this doesn't work, we just will keep going. You know, we can go somewhere else and move forward. I had not ever actually been to Boulder when we agreed to it. But, you know, again, I know what I'm capable of, the resiliency that I hold. And so I thought I can make anything work, you know, and it's just whether we choose to stay there for the duration. So we came to Boulder and we very quickly got pregnant with my second child. And, you know, really at that point, I thought, okay, I'm just going to hit pause here and take some time off and just, you know, have the family and then come back into this later. And really, you know, was very active in staying close with the guys that I'd worked with, the analysts that we'd worked with. You know, I think those relationships still today, I mean, they're just, those guys are so dear to me. Then when my fourth child was born and she had this allergic reaction, it was the sense of knowing that everything up until that point I could channel and leverage to try to drive change. And it felt like that was the smartest and most important use of my time. I knew at that point that most people that have been talking about food system reform were kind of labeled as like the elite on either coast. And I could see how this was actually, you know, conserving our health could be reframed and repackaged as a conservative issue. I felt that it was completely nonpartisan. And when I was looking at the data around the rates of cancer and things like that, I thought like cancer doesn't care which side of the aisle we're on. It doesn't care where we live. I knew that there was a way to articulate it that could mainstream it. I was very, very early. And so as you can imagine, there were a lot of people, especially like looking at just on the surface, this blonde mother of four that just wanted to blow me out of the water. And they tried. And, you know, when you pull financial statements and you have an understanding of all of that and you can pull 990s, you look at all these things, like you're like, okay, that's fine. You may hate me as a messenger, but it doesn't change the story. And that was really clear. They hated me as the messenger, but it didn't change the story. And I had to find the resilience and the fortitude to keep going. And, you know, in that process, you lose people. You do lose people who just are like, yeah, that's just way too out there. I'm not going to go with you. And then you find your people. You find the people that are like, that is an incredible vision. And the data that you're presenting makes so much sense. What do you need to help get there? And so, you know, you sort of transition into a new cohort. And I went through that experience. And, you know, the people that wrapped around me in the early years of this work are as close as family, as non-family people can be. I love them. I want the best for them. I want the best for their families. And I still hold them so dearly and so close. But really, you know, it was just fascinating to have had this very traditional finance background, to have that traditional experience in the finance sector, and then to come back to that and say that's actually what we need to start to actually look at the fiduciary duty here and understand that this is part of it. You know, this is part of it, that these assets of clean air, clean water, clean soil, like they're actually, whether we have them on the balance sheet or not, they're on the balance sheet. And if we're abusing them, it's going to be detrimental to the health of that business. And if we actually value them as an asset, then that's an additive thing to the business. And again, like nothing in me was climate. There was nothing in me in my upbringing that was this. And so had been on just this incredibly vertical learning curve. And as I was on that learning curve, I was paying attention to sort of the emotions that would accompany it, the reactions of people that were with me and that would accompany it. And I thought, you know, how do we articulate this? How do we talk about this? That helps people realize that we're all part of this together. And this isn't any kind of like finger pointing or othering. This is all of us. Like, how do we actually take care of this together so that your kids are fine, my kids are fine, your grandkids are fine, my grandkids are fine, and kind of put that longer, you know, that longer lens on it.
Let me be a skeptic for a second. And I don't necessarily believe this, but I'm going to act like I do. So you're a granola, Boulder, Colorado, far left. You have that mantra. Yet it's weird. You came from, I'm going to say, Wall Street. So how in the heck do you view the world? That's one thing in this context. But then I want to go, but give me some concrete examples. Ultimately, of probably what you wrote in your first book, The Unhealthy Truth, How Our Food System or Food is Making Us Sick. Put some teeth on that with a couple of examples so that it doesn't just feel like it's all ethereal. We all love each other, hug each other, and have sunflower seeds or something.
So, you know, some of the data that was in the first book is that cancer is the leading cause of death by disease in American kids under the age of 15. Like, that's a data point. And it was the president's cancer panel, which was originally formed under Bush and released. I think in the early years of the work, there were data points that were so incredibly powerful to me that I couldn't unlearn them. And as I sat with them and sat with that data and thought, you know, what's happening with this data? You know, it required action. It felt I was called to action. And one of the data points that was the most powerful to me is that cancer is the leading cause of death by disease in American children under the age of 15. And it's in the President's Cancer Report, which was originally convened under the Bush administration and then released under the Obama administration. And as you said, you know, like coming to Boulder from Houston, that stereotype, the granola, the hippie, the crunchy, like that's exactly how I looked at it. And then at the same time, I was hearing that stereotype reflect back on what they were saying. So I think for me, the data was really compelling. And as somebody who had been sort of on the quant side of thing and understood that data tells the story, was realizing that there's an incredible story here. And one of the data points that was the most powerful was that cancer is the leading cause of death by disease in American kids under the age of 15. And I thought, nobody is talking about this. Why is nobody talking about this? And what can we be doing to exercise precaution? And then to realize that the American food companies were formulating their products differently overseas. So they would put these cheaper artificial ingredients into the products here, you know, artificial colors and all those things. And then they put real ingredients in products they were selling in the UK or Europe or Australia. And I thought that double standard was intolerable to me. And so you could literally put side by side the labels for what was happening on a cereal bar in Europe versus the labels of what was happening in the US, and you could see the difference. And then you can go to the science and understand why other countries were keeping these ingredients out. And that double standard was a really powerful, you know, talking point. And it didn't matter if I was in front of an organization of farmers, an organization of mothers, if I was at Bloomberg, if I was at Morgan Stanley, that double standard was universally offensive. And so be able to speak to that conservative background that I'd had with this incredible finance background that I'd had. And then, like you said, landing in Boulder, which is granola, you know, the stereotype was that it was, I would say, you know, 25 years ago, it was very granola, very hippie. Now it's very Silicon Valley here. So it's changed so much. But, you know, at the time, it was that stereotype. And I think that's what they came at me with, that energy, like, oh, let's just blow this woman out of the water. And it was the way I had been raised in that conservative, trying to understand the insult that we had not been given this informed choice and that this double standard existed. It felt so un-American. It felt like such a violation. And so I could, as a Houstonian, I could look at Boulder and see, you know, exactly what you've described. And then living in Boulder, I could then look at Houston and see what they describe. And I have always been a bridge builder. And my goal was to build the bridge between those two sides because I thought, We're actually on the same team. And it doesn't matter if you live in Boulder and someone you love is diagnosed with cancer, or if you live in Houston and someone you love is diagnosed with cancer, like our hearts all break the same way. So this sort of separateness that had been created was completely inefficient in trying to actually create a movement around this. And so early on, that's how I operated, was as a bridge builder, which was interesting because there were people that were on the organic side were like, you can't do that. You need to be, you can't sit at the table with the CEO of Nestlé. And I'm like, well, then how do you change anything if you're not willing to sit down with them and hear what's holding them back and offer resources and tools that could help accelerate this? That bridge between those two sides, because of this very unique background that I happen to have, is what I felt the responsibility towards. And there were plenty of those granola hippies that had worked with the scientists, had been developing these things, yet they weren't going to be the right messenger for this message. And so, really sort of honoring the different components of it felt really important. And then, figuring out a way to articulate it. And that was really, again, it gets back to the communication piece. Having studied French and Spanish and Japanese and accounting and finance, those are all languages. So, how we chose to talk about this. And for me, the sort of central point was that American children had earned this nickname of Generation RX because of the rates of cancer and autism and allergies and ADHD, and they had done nothing to deserve that. And the responsibility that I felt towards that, whether I was at the pool with the kids or at the park with the kids or picking up the kids from school, and you look, and then the mom started to know that I was, really leaning into this research, and then people just started flooding my phone and flooding my emails with different stories. And I mean, that was a very interesting part of the journey, because when people flood you with that type of heartache, learning how to hold it and also take care of yourself as people are going through these different levels of grief, I realized then also was sort of part of the work. And again, to be so lucky to be somewhere that is healthy, where I could get outside and go for a run or take a hike to help process a lot of the stuff that was coming in. But over the years, I mean, I'm still close with families that have lost children to cancer and lost children to allergic reactions. And I mean, it never comes up what side of the aisle somebody's on.
Two questions for you. I want you to give as concise answers as you can, just because I want to make it as simple as you can. How would you define the progress that's been made since whenever you started to today?
Yeah, thankfully, I've seen a lot of progress. It's been really interesting thinking about the people that I reached out to in the early years of the work, including Bobby Kennedy. So intentionally building this as a nonpartisan movement to then see what he has created is one of the movements that is now attached to this. So the 15 years since the publication of that first book, to have gone from somebody that was marginalized and condemned to something that is now a central talking point for presidential elections, I'm really proud of the work that I've done and that others have done. So many people on both sides of the aisle have worked on this, and it's been incredible to watch it happen, to see the response from multinational CEOs, policymakers. We've created films. I'm an executive producer on Common Ground, which again, we were intentional including Republican and Democrat voices in that film. And to be able to see that kind of change in this lifetime, I'm so grateful for. And also at the same time, we're just barely scratching the surface.
And then my other very quick question that I'd ask you is, if you had to give a simple answer of how or why did we get so far off the path, what is, and I get it's probably multi-causal, but if you just had to throw one, what would you say?
My response to that question would be the quickest solution forward, the quickest way to solve for this right now is subsidies. So I've worked with the World Bank for the last 6 years on different things, and they released a report last year called Detox Development, Repurposing Environmentally Harmful Subsidies. And they talk about how there's $7.3 trillion in subsidies in agrochemicals, fossil fuels, and fisheries that literally are subsidizing the destruction of human health and planet health. The World Bank, like this, we're not talking Greenpeace, we're not talking some like radical lefty organization. This is the World Bank basically saying we're subsidizing the destruction of the planet, and it is making business on this planet harder. And again, like you've got to look at this from an economic lens, and you've got to look at this from a financial lens. And that's what the World Bank did. And so they said, people say, oh, there's not enough resources, we don't have the money. They call bull on that, and there's like $7.3 trillion. Let's flip that. Let's actually start allocating this into systems that are more regenerative and are able to so better protect these resources. So I would say that's the biggest lever. And if I'm the CEO of General Mills or Mars or Exxon, the subsidies are completely dictating that business model. And it's a bucket of capital that has such tremendous influence that are our tax dollars hard at work against our health. And to have an ally like the World Bank come forward on this has been pretty remarkable over the last couple of years. The European Central Bank is saying the same thing. They're basically saying nature needs to be on the balance sheet because of how critical it is to the success, not only of us as humans, but of any business. And so I think it's that again, it's just we're waking up to the fact that we've been extracting these resources, not actually putting them on balance sheets and valuing them for the assets that they are. And then at the same time, we've been subsidizing these really destructive systems. And if we were to just reallocate the subsidies, that alone would do it would align, so many goals.
Who is making the decisions to subsidize in the historical way or current way that we are subsidizing?
I think it's an operating system that was set in place in the 20th century before we knew how destructive it actually was. And in my second book, In Seeding Innovation, I cite a report that Exxon scientists released early when they were basically saying, hey, the fossil fuel industry is actually destroying the planet. And I loved it because it came straight out of Exxon. I mean, it was their own scientists, sort of throwing up a flag on this thing. And yet we had sort of locked into this system. And so, what we're talking about is systems change. And when I've worked with these multinational food companies, they're like, okay, our bread and butter is on this side. And we're afraid that if we start talking about better for you or free from, that it's somehow going to cannibalize this side. So I'm like, at this point, we need hybrid models. We need hybrid models. Whether we're talking about clean food or clean energy, we need hybrid models. And then as we start to reallocate, subsidies and as consumer demand continues to shift, you're at least positioned to capture both sides. And I think part of the problem is that the attitude has been to vilify and it's got to be either or. We don't live in a world where we can flip that switch overnight in the food system or in the energy sector because of the infrastructure that has been built over the last century. And so, to really look at that infrastructure, and that's what we're doing in the food industry right now, we're looking at these supply chains and that infrastructure, and we're saying, where does capital need to be allocated to then start to transition this farmland? And it is not easy because when you're looking at farmland that's been continually sort of sprayed and treated with these chemicals over the years, to then remove those chemicals and treat the weeds and treat everything in a different way requires different equipment. It requires different passes. It requires different practices. So there's education that's needed. There's the financing of the ops that's needed. And so, I think when people get into these little sound bites and try to get really simplistic on it, it's not a simple solution. It's systems change. And so we need to, sit down and think about that and how we're going to be allocating capital to literally redesign these systems in a smarter, more efficient way.
As you're talking, one of the things that hit me was how polarizing we are today. And I'll give an example in my direct world is one of the things that we do is we do some stuff in Africa around power generation because half of Africa doesn't have access to power. And so turns out that everything we do is renewable. You talk it to one side and they're like, oh, that's the Green New Deal, that you had spent a baloney. You talk to the other side and it's like, oh, you're going to save the world, and the truth is really in the middle. And and look, I care about it all, but fundamentally in our case, you need power that economically makes sense. Number one, because then it'll be sustainable. And number two, in this case, actually the resources at hand that are best to drive it are actually water, hydro, solar. And so both sides are actually wrong. And you're like, no, it's a melding of the two. So I understand that. And it's sad because I generally go into conversation, if we start talking about this, there's a general sense that the people are going to be on one side or the other. And so I too have actually feel called to be a bridge builder in the sense that take those two extremes in the environmental side. We may disagree on the why, but I think when you actually come together, it's like, yeah, if you can get power cheaper to
It's economics. I mean, it's economics. It's, in the early years of my work, and people are like, you should be advocating only for organic. And I'm like, organic is so out of reach financially for so many families because of the structure that we've talked about. Farmers have to pay fees to prove their stuff is safe. They have to pay fees to label it. They have to pay fees to certify it. So the whole cost of production on the organic side is higher, and it's also not subsidized. Meanwhile, we subsidize stuff that's just being routinely sprayed with all these chemicals. They don't have to prove that, so it's again, it's you have to have a really deep and good understanding of economics, and that's what we're talking about. And so it's like if you're going to present something to somebody and it's economically not viable, they're going to blow you out of the water. So you've got to be focused on how do we create an economic viability plan here? And that's why I think the World Bank coming out with subsidies and $7.3 trillion, that's a great place to start. To actually reimagine the economics of these different systems. If I were to get in front of people and say, oh, organic's all this and it's got a halo on its head and it's better for you, but you can't afford it. I mean, they're going to hate me for getting in front of them for that. More, how do we actually make this financially viable? One of the best examples that I have on that is that as the sector started to grow, and 75% of us are buying something organic some of the time, maybe not your whole fridge is organic, but there's probably something in the fridge that is organic. And categories in grocery stores are largely going organic, and we see it in every sector from pet food to baby food to milk. You can go in the grocery store and see the organics. What's fascinating is that the grocery stores themselves caught that data. Every time you're scanning at the checkout, they're catching all your data, and they could see that consumers were wanting organic, and so they launched their private label brand. So the Safeway organic brand or the Costco organic brand. The best example I have for that is when that concept was presented to the CEO of Kroger. They had nothing. They had nothing in the private label that was organic. When the concept was presented, he was smart enough to be able to see that data, see that it was what his consumers were asking for. And so they launched the private label brand, the Simple Truth organic brand, inside of King Soopers, Kroger's, that entire chain of stores. And it went from zero to $1 billion in revenue in less than a 2-year period. It's one of the fastest growing food brands in the country. It quickly hit the size of like Cheerios. Again, it's how are we reading this data? What is the data actually telling us? And then what are the economics behind the infrastructure that needs to be addressed to create this change? And it is going to be interesting over the years to see what happens. You're starting to see these, I mean, the example of the food system hitting the presidential election the way it has this year in such a meaningful way is an indicator of other systems that will be hitting these conversations in years to come. And so I get it. It's like I wasn't raised this way. I didn't think about these things. I had to unlearn and relearn and put your ego in your back pocket and be open to learning from people who may have been talking about this before you got there. But the flip side of that is that the opportunity that's in it is incredible. And we see that. The fastest growing sector in food and beverage right now is the non-alcoholic sector. And so, it's like, could anyone have imagined that 20 years ago? No, not at all. What's the data telling us? And instead of fighting the data, how do you want to participate in it?
So again, I'm gonna poke the bear a little bit. Are you a capitalist? How would you describe yourself?
Yes, but I think what we miss with capitalism is that human capital is a key component here. Our ability to innovate and create and solve for. And so, yes, I'm a capitalist, but if we're creating systems that are detrimental to human health, then we're ignoring the human capital component. And so I would say, let's expand this a little bit. Yes, I'm a capitalist, and let's expand this, because there's capital, soil health. Soil is an incredible resource. Let's expand the definition of capitalism to be more comprehensive.
I couldn't agree more with you. That's exactly where I came after 20 years of being in traditional finance. And really, to me, I'd add two things to the definition when I talk about capitalism. And not that these are excluded, but I think they need more emphasis. One, I would go back to your point of data. But the other thing I would argue, there's nothing wrong with adding heart into capital. And that's, it sounds cheesy, but realistically, it's that simple. So let me do this. Describe for us, and maybe you've already done this, when did you realize the power of capital? And we've been hearing examples of that, but you may answer differently. When did you realize the power of capital, and what does that mean to you?
I realized it really early on in my career. I was the only woman on my team. On Thursdays, we hosted institutional investors across the floor. And so we took turns on who had to kind of host those investors and show them the trading desk and do all those things. And I remember one of them, said, is it intimidating to you at all? Reviewing the material and offering a trade and suggesting these things, does the size of the trade intimidate you in any way? And I just looked at him and was like, it doesn't change my analysis. Like if I was doing this analysis for $1 or $1 billion, it doesn't change the analysis, And so it's like the decision is based on the analysis. But I think it was really that was in the very early years. We were moving such large money. It's such an early informative part of my career. And I'm so grateful for that exposure and the men that I worked for that allowed me to have it. They were incredible. I mean, they were incredible men. And so I would say it was in the very early years of the work. And then I was really working on food system reform and spending so much time educating CEOs, working with their boards, helping the boards understand. But then it just quickly revealed that it was the capital, so it was really the capital source, and that's really where the education and the focus had to be. And again, it's an incredible opportunity. Instead of this attitude of either or, as we expand into better for you, right now we're sort of in the stage of both and. And I think that's the right approach is, right now it's both and. And then it's like, who knows 20 years from now what our kids are going to be inventing and what will have revealed itself to them as part of these solutions. And to hold that space for that possibility. I'm an optimist, and most people that I know who are, active in these spaces, we are optimists. And it drives this imaginative process and the hope of what's possible. And I think to ignore that capital somehow isn't part of that, I mean, that sounds delusional, candidly. So let's infuse it with purpose and values and regenerative meaning, to build systems that can hold all of us, our kids and our grandkids.
Do you think about or use the vernacular stewardship?
I don't think I use that word as much as I live it. I feel that my life is in service in this capacity, and I'm one of many. I don't at all think that I'm the only one who can do this. My goal is always to inspire others to realize they can do the same. What is it that lights you up? What is it that you're really good at? Lend those things. That's what the world needs, is for you to come fully alive. To me, that's what stewardship is to be in the fullest service at the highest level with the gifts that you've been given. And so I, rather than talk about it, I really just try to live that.
Well, that's exactly the people we want to be talking to. And actually, you and I had met before, and you actually, I mean, everybody sees this and knows it. When they meet somebody like that, there's just this, you don't have to say anything. You know that they're living it out. So it definitely comes through when chat. I have two more questions. Let me think in what order. Let me do this first question, just given your expertise. If you were to explain to people what regenerative farming is, how would you describe that?
I would say you leave the soil better than you found it. And I did not talk about this. I was not educated on this stuff. Like, I was not the granola hippie person. So, but when I really learned that whatever we do to the soil, we're doing to ourselves. So if we're treating it with loads of chemicals, you might as well just act like that's on your kitchen table. And if that chemical is just abusing the soil and the health of the soil underneath and the nutrients underneath, then guess what? The food that we're growing in that soil isn't growing in a healthy way. And so if you come in with regenerative agriculture, which is regenerating, which is literally giving life back into the soil, you regenerate that soil, then all of a sudden the nutrition comes back and its ability to hold water comes back and its ability to, hold carbon comes back. And so if we think of soil, the way we've been treating it sort of turned it into like a concrete rock when really it should be this incredibly healthy, vibrant, living organism. That's what regenerative is. It's just restoring the health of the soil so that everything that's coming out of there is healthier for all of us and our families. And then at the same time, it's just a healthier conduit for all of these different biosystems, from water to carbon to air.
If there was one way to describe to people what that practically means, I know there's multiple examples of what you do. What is there one thing that you would go, practically, if you could just do this, it would at least start the process?
I think more important than what I would say is the years and decades that I've been working with farmers is what they say. And what farmers would say was you halt the chemical applications, because the farmers were not the first to say, hey, this is bad for us. That was the system that they had inherited. That was a system that they had invested in. That was a system that they were using. And yet what started to happen on the farm was that the farmers could literally see what was happening to the health of the soil that wasn't holding water. That's a really obvious example of poor soil health. The water just runs off and you're losing everything when you're losing the water that way. And so the farmers started to see that as a concern. And then the way that the crops were growing started to suffer. And so they would say it's stop the chemical applications, just rethink the actual treatment of the soil. And one of the ways that they do that is they put down cover crops, and it's just these little crops. They put the little crops in, and what that does is that brings the nutrition back into the soil and it brings the living organisms up in the soil. So you have a healthier soil system. When you have a healthier soil system, you have healthier plants coming off, everything becomes easier to manage. So the farmers would probably say, stop the chemical applications and introduce these newer these practices that from generations past of cover crops and other systems. It's a fascinating time. It's an incredibly powerful sector to be involved in. And, when I think about food security as national security, which I do, and that's the conservative in me, it's why are we not doing everything we can to make sure that our food system is secure, to make sure that we are growing crops and producing products that Americans want to eat rather than importing them from all over the world because there's such vulnerability in that. I mean, I've really, for a long time before anybody was talking about it, was saying food security is national security. I believe that to my toes. And so protecting the farm economy, protecting soil health, to me, those are national security measures.
Yeah, and what from my analysis, but you're seeing this space financially work. And so the more that it works, the more this thing is going to move in that direction, even though there will be real forces that'll stop it. So I'm actually very encouraged when you see some of the data of, yeah, you're reducing a bunch of your input cost, which that right there, let alone with inflation and all that kind of stuff. So it's actually kind of exciting.
Farmer named Rick Clark that I've been friends with for a long time. He's in Indiana. He's a Republican, and you know, he's really proud that he doesn't take government handouts now since he transitioned his farm. And he speaks to the economics. I mean, it's all about the economics. It's like you can't convince anyone of anything if the economics don't work. And I think a lot of these movements get really loud, and the activists get really loud without that understanding of the fundamental economics that are required to really transition these things. And that's the conversation. That's the conversation.
Okay, my last two questions. The first one is the situation with your kids and their health, and you know, what did you see progress? Is there hope? Any thoughts there?
Yeah, you know, it's interesting. I mean, I was super mindful. I didn't want them to have a weird relationship with food. And it was one of those things where I was like, how do I offer this in a way that they keep a healthy relationship with food? And so I could show them if your skin is clearer, if you feel better, if you have a headache, you know, allow them to experiment with these different things. When you feel good, when you feel off, and let's really think about these things. And so early on, that was the approach that I took. And you know, like parenting anything, I mean, it's like you're seeding it and you're seeding it and you're seeding it, and it's 100 times, and you're hoping it all sticks. I don't think I really realized that it had stuck until they were in college. And then, you know, my son, that's a rugby player, would call and say, Mom, you know, this is what I'm thinking. This is what I want to buy. These are supplements I want to take. And I was like, okay, wow, this like it went in. And it's really, I think, again, it's like you want to operate at your highest capacity. And, you know, we're like cars. If you put crap into a car, it's not going to perform well. If you do that to a human body, it's not going to perform well. And so, again, not to be in a polarizing place, and I don't, because I've worked with families and groups across the entire socioeconomic, you know, spectrum. And it's really do the best you can with what you have. And, you know, as much as you can, avoid the ultra processed stuff that really just don't even contain real food. Make these choices, and you can do them in baby steps. And to me, that's the most accessible approach.
Yeah, it's funny. I won't go too in depth, but my A1C slightly elevated, cholesterol's slightly high, and so, and I've done multiple things, but this time it's pretty simple. There's actually a program out there called Full Plate or something. It doesn't really matter, but it's at the heart of it. It's 75% of your stuff on your plate should be grains, fruits, vegetables, real food. And it's like, it's not that, I mean, I say that it's not that hard, except it's just hard to get it on your plate. But if you just eat real food, you're like halfway there.
I mean, again, I think, you know, so much of this was well intended at the start, you know, like to be able to provide, you know, quick meals and fast food. I mean, that was well intended. And, you know, several years in, we start to realize, oh, there are all these externalized costs and all these consequences. And so, again, it's how do we recalibrate? You know, we do that ourselves over our lifetimes. We're recalibrating in our relationships, we're recalibrating, you know, in our careers. I feel that there's a pretty loud call to action right now. We really got to recalibrate, you know, this food system.
If you could have one dream or two dreams come true in your life, and because you're such an interesting person, I'm going to say leave your family out of it, because I'll assume your family are in there. What would be one or two dreams if you could have come true for your life? And it could be, doesn't have to be grandiose, it could be small. I don't really care. Just curious what you'd say.
I mean, I think the biggest thing is for people to believe in their ability to create and drive change. And to me, the greatest fear I had was that I would get to my 80s and look back and wonder if I could have done more and been in service more. And, you know, I think what we've got to do is stop and say each one of us is such a unique design with unique passions and unique skills and unique talents. And are you lending that, you know, to your highest capacity? Because then when you do, you're just personally, you're operating at such a high level. And for people to believe in their ability to drive that change, and I don't care if it's at your local level, if it's at the state level, if you want to do something more grandiose at the national or global level, but to get involved in that participation, that's what I always say. I want to see 100% participation, that there's so many opportunities to get engaged, to drive all of these systems forward, you know, for our kids and our grandkids. And, you know, that's the thing is like, when your grandkids are looking at you and all this data is on the table to be able to say, this is how I participated. You know, I went to a movie I didn't think I would like. I read a book. I, you know, consider something. It doesn't have to be grandiose, but to really, I invite people to kind of look at what they're afraid of and think if they could do it afraid anyway. And that's a lot of the work that I do because fear has ridden shotgun to absolutely all of it. You know, fear has been a steady companion. And I've realized that it's really just this like seatbelt that just keeps me locked in my comfort zone. And I've learned to work with that fear. And it's really helped me unpack a lot of these things. And so, you know, for everybody that's listening, it's just believe in your ability to drive change, whatever that looks like. I mean, the first keynote I gave, the first talk I gave, there were six people there, you know, and now I can speak at something with thousands of people. It's like, just start. You know, I think the thing we need to be afraid of is of doing nothing. If you have anything to fear, it's the fear of doing nothing. So, you know, think about what you love. Think about the talents that you have. Think about where you want to lend those talents. Grab a friend because it helps make it so much more doable and easier to step into, you know, this courageous, braver action when you have somebody beside you, you know, that you can do it together. And it's whether, you know, if you're hosting a movie night, you're hosting a book club, you're getting involved in some organization for the first time. If you do it with somebody else, it makes it easier. But really, for everybody listening, it's believe in your ability. Believe in your abilities to drive change.
Well, I could ask 100 more questions because part of that's just the way God has wired me. So thank you for sharing. And because of that, I'm going to ask you one more question and then we'll be done. I know this is a loaded question. So, and the question is give me two documentaries. One could be one that you're associated with because I'm assuming you would recommend that. And one that maybe is not. If you could give us go, these are two documentaries. If you want to learn more about this, this is where I'd send you. And is that a fair question? Can you give one that's not your own?
Yeah, it's a fair question. I think so. Common Ground, I'm an executive producer on Common Ground, and it is going to hit the main streaming platforms very soon. And it's beautifully done because it has that balance of both sides of the aisle, which I just think is so critically important. So I would say Common Ground. Second to that, I would say, I mean, the one that's coming to mind, which is highly entertaining and also rather shocking in a great way, is Inside Job. And it's about Wall Street and the power of Wall Street. And it's eye-opening. It's a little bit hard to stomach. And then, you know, a third I would add because I'm an optimist and I like ending things on a solution. Dear friends of mine, Molly and John Chester, have a documentary called The Biggest Little Farm.
I was wondering if you could say that. I watched that on a airplane one time.
It's so inspiring, and they took a piece of absolutely dead land and brought it back to life. They had no background in it whatsoever and hired the specialist that they needed. He was a National Geographic photographer. She was a LA chef. The story of the way they brought that land back to life with all of the plants and the animals and the bees and their little boy is so beautiful. And it's such a great example of what's possible. You know, I think what I've learned in my life is you do have to be able to stare the hard stuff in the eye. You can't pretend that it doesn't exist because the solution is on the other side of that understanding. And that's what I would hope that everybody's listening today, you know, leaves with is like you have the ability to make an incredible impact, you know, whether it's in the life of your family, your community, your town, your state, your country. You really do have the ability to make an incredible impact. And the thing to remember is to do it from that place of deep authenticity. You are not supposed to be like anyone else in this. You know, that your highest purpose and calling comes out of that authenticity.
Not that I live this out, but this idea of making a difference. I mean, just go when you're checking out your grocery and speaking to that person with authenticity and how you're doing, appreciate your, I mean, like that just blows people away right there because that's outside of the norm. And let's face it, that is so simple to do, but how many of us do it regularly? Well,
Yeah, it goes a really long way.
goes a long way. So, all right, I have gone way too long. Thank you so much. Really appreciate it. We'll have your books in the information as we publish this. We'll look for Common Ground.
Yep, Common Ground.
Common Ground. We'll look for that. And appreciate your courage to step out and fight some of these battles. And hopefully, as we move forward, you'll continue to see your work as well as others, because I know you're the first to recognize that it's not going to get done by you. It's going to be done by a cohort of people. So it's awesome. So don't forget to subscribe to New Lens with Common Good Capital on your podcast app of choice. Please rate and review us so that others might find the show and hopefully be on a path to a more fulfilling portfolio in the impact investing space. Till next time, I'm Jeff Schaefer. This podcast is a production of Common Good Capital and does not constitute an offer or a solicitation of an offer.
Such offer would only be made through a private placement memorandum. Prospective investors in private placement securities should be aware that making an investment is speculative and involves a high degree of risk, including the risk of losing all or a portion of an investment. Investments of this nature are illiquid and subject to substantial restrictions upon transferability.